Thank you. Good afternoon. When we came into office, the National-led government immediately moved on increasing the government's investment in productive infrastructure and improving the regulations that govern infrastructure development. The aim was to unclog the arteries of the economy. We've invested heavily in the last three budgets in infrastructure, like schools and ultra-fast broadband, alongside record investments in our electricity and state highway networks. We've also improved the way the government plans, consents and finances infrastructure by reforming the Resource Management Act, improving spending disciplines and making greater use of public-private partnerships. The investment is supporting thousands of jobs, but more importantly, it's setting a platform for future economic growth. So today we have released the second National Infrastructure Plan, which is the next step in getting smarter about how we plan and develop infrastructure so we can get the best services and value for taxpayers. I'm now going to hand over to Bill and Stephen to talk a bit more about the National Infrastructure Plan. We'll take any questions you have about that, and then we'll take some other comments and further questions you might have for the rest of the press conference.
Well, as the Prime Minister has said, we've taken several steps to improve New Zealand's infrastructure, and in the 2008 campaign we promised to create a national infrastructure plan so that the infrastructure industry could have certainty, but so that we also so we could just lay out the intentions of government, local government, private sector to some extent, in a way that meant that we could have a constructive and forward-looking debate about what infrastructure we need for a growing economy. So the plan shows very large investment we have in the pipeline, about $17 billion over the next 4 years, and that's excluding Canterbury. So if you add theirs, and we're looking at a program of over $22 billion. And in addition to that, there's the SOE investment in their own infrastructure. What's become clear, though, is we need to get smarter about how we plan the infrastructure, smarter about how we execute it, and also smarter about how we manage a large base of existing infrastructure. Too often the debate is limited to what's required as new spend, when we already have a large stock which could be used better. So the plan sets out a 20-year strategic vision. It identifies what we regard as the most important challenges, outlines the government's priorities, and puts in place an action plan to do a better job. So the priorities over the next 3 years will be first rebuilding Canterbury, secondly a comprehensive approach to investment in Auckland, thirdly improving the management of government-owned social infrastructure, prisons, hospitals, schools, housing, fourthly, focusing transport investment on supporting exports through the roads of national significance and better rail performance. And finally, improving the government's ability to monitor performance across infrastructure sectors. The government's committed itself to lifting the growth rate of the economy. And I think the infrastructure plan is an important step in us getting ahead of the growth curve. We don't want to get caught out by a fast-growing economy for which we don't have the infrastructure in place. And a critical part of the plan is scenarios for a faster-growing economy and the kind of investment that's going to be needed to support that. And I'll just hand over to Mr. Joyce.
Thanks, Bill, Prime Minister. Just a couple of quick words to focus on two areas that have been particularly emphasised in recent years in New Zealand, the transport and telecommunications networks. As we know, they are very important to achieving faster economic growth. In the case of transport, the plan notes that the government is focused on creating the most efficient mix of options to improve productivity and our economic growth prospects. And integral to this is a network approach that effectively links our rail infrastructure, our sea and airports, and the roading network. The plan highlights our progress, both in terms of increased funding and getting bigger projects through the planning stages much more quickly. It also highlights some areas for further attention, including specific regions where economic and population growth place pressure on some parts of our transport infrastructure. Auckland-Wellington and the rebuild of Christchurch are key to this. The roads of national significance, the increased passenger rail investment in Auckland and Wellington are all examples of the government responding to those needs, and we will continue to do so over that next 20-year period. The rollout of fibre optic technology is very important, as we know, to getting a transformational change in the New Zealand economy to both the rural and urban communities through the two separate government broadband initiatives. We had the first meeting of the Rural Broadband Working Group together here in Wellington this morning, and the various stakeholders are looking to leverage the absolute benefits they can out of that process. And of course, the Urban Broadband Initiative is proceeding well with the legislation being passed in recent weeks. Those are equally important to the transport side and arguably have a bigger a transformational effect on the New Zealand economy in the years ahead. Thanks.
Question? Question for the Finance Minister. Of the $17 billion, how much of this money has not been announced in the previous budgets over the last 3 years?
Oh, it's all projects that are in train, so I'd be surprised if any of it hadn't been announced. And the plan's not a vehicle for announcing new projects, it's a vehicle for setting out a 10 to 20 year horizon. It does canvas funding issues because we need to be able to pay for any new infrastructure we want. But we've got a reasonable degree of confidence that the plans are matched by reasonable expectations of funding. They're not pipe dreams.
Can I turn the question around and say, is there anything that's missing from the previous plan or the current one?
I think the current plan is just a much more sophisticated document. I don't think it would cover any individual investment that hasn't been talked about over the last two or three years. But it does things like shows sector by sector who's in charge of it and where the money's come from in a way that hasn't been visible before. It provides ratings for different aspects of infrastructure management across our main sectors, and that shows that we need quite significant improvement in how we manage our infrastructure. So we're shifting the focus from just new plans for new infrastructure, because you're pretty familiar with those in any case, like the roads of national significance or the rollout of ultra-fast broadband, shifting it towards getting a framework in place which central government, local government and the private sector can all use to focus on what is a pretty critical aspect of our economic growth plan.
So have you taken the focus away from anything at all, as you put it, on Christchurch, one of these other things? I mean, I guess we have to have trouble reading the document in the light of the previous statements you made to see what's actually changed.
Oh, well, I mean, as I said, what's changed is a much more sophisticated approach to how we're thinking through infrastructure and a toolkit that everyone who's involved can use. I mean, we could go through and compare one with the other. I'm sure you'd do that. But this one brings together the information and an assessment of the state of our infrastructure, which is going to be a much better basis for good decision-making over the next few years.
When you look at the energy sector, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it says that central and government capital expenditure will be zero on this between 2011 and 2015. I mean, is that because you're flipping nothing off, or why is that?
Oh, no, just because the way it's counted excludes the SOEs. I mean, they're self-contained businesses which take money in from their funds and from their consumers, and from that they fund their capital investment. They do have significant capital investment plans.
So does this mean that the government won't be putting any money into new energy generation capital investments around energy companies?
It's always possible for the government to do that. At the moment, we don't plan to inject taxpayers' money in, because those businesses are able to, at the moment, they're sourcing sufficient capital by themselves, either from the debt markets or from their consumers, to be able to maintain what's been a pretty high rate of investment.
Is that a standard position? I mean, I've looked at this issue that carefully, but I mean, would the government normally put money into energy generation capital investment into those energy companies?
It hasn't done that as far back as I can recall, except maybe the peaking plant in Hawke's Bay, Whirinaki. But generally, these businesses have financed their own capital. So it's not the government putting money in that builds the gas turbine generators, it's the consumers paying their bills.
Does that apply to Kiwi Bank as well? Do you expect that any capital that needs to be found within
Post Office? No, not automatically. They're going through a strategic review right now, and you know, we'll hear from the board of management of POST about what they think might be is required.
So there could be some, but it's just not covered. It's not mentioned in this plan.
No, that's right. I mean, generally our approach is to where investment is sensible for the Crown to make, we will go ahead and make it, and I think we've demonstrated that over the last couple of years, because despite the fact that we've had large deficits, we've continued to invest at record levels in our infrastructure, particularly the roading, and notably Kiwi Rail, which is actually in a $4.5 billion turnaround program, as well as the ultra-fast broadband.
The increase in the value of the state assets from $2 billion, is that including the partial privatisations? Well, the partial privatisations don't make any accounting difference for the Crown,
right? We get cash. If we end up doing those sell downs, we get the cash. Someone else gets a share certificate. But the growth in value is driven by partly by further investment in infrastructure, partly by the growth of our finance funds like ACC and the Super Fund, and partly from self-contained investment like the SLEs.
Water infrastructure doesn't make it onto your list of priorities, but it didn't score very well in the ratings area. Is there a reason for that?
The way to think about the priorities is you can't make everything a top priority, so rebuilding Christchurch is obviously an urgent and important need. With respect to water, the focus there is on two things. One is progressing with irrigation in Canterbury, as government signalled in the budget, and the other is on improving the management of existing water assets, so which is to a large extent a local body issue. But that's just the benefit of the plan, is the analysis shows that that's the sector where there's room for the most improvement in the performance of existing infrastructure.
There was quite a damaging report about the quality in the southern area. Does that not raise your concern about doing something about water quality in terms of good infrastructure and treatment plants, especially in small towns?
Oh, yeah, well, we recognised that when we came in as government. It had been 10 years of inaction under the previous government. Lots of rhetoric, but nothing happened. And so what we did is, in the way the government often does, has been doing a lot, and that is set up a forum for getting a consensus about A, the problem, and B, the solution. So the Land and Water Forum's now been running for a couple of years. It's produced a report which represents, you know, a big step forward, because it's taken an issue that's been often paralysed by quite strong contradictory lobbying group positions and formed a consensus. And at the time we started that a couple of years ago, we said it would take 5 years to get somewhere. You know, the problem of water quality is growing in profile, and we would expect, you know, to be starting to make significant policy decisions. Well, we shifted some of those subsidy schemes around. They were aimed at poorer communities, and we've targeted them better. But the drinking water quality, we brought in standards. Well, the previous government started it. We've implemented this requirement for higher standards, and local bodies are moving to comply with them.
Are we updating the plan for another 3 years?
What's that?
Why aren't we updating the plan for another 3 years?
Because infrastructure is a long cycle, and there's plenty to do in there over the next 3 years. Things don't change a lot. I mean, as was pointed out earlier, the projects covered have largely been signalled up to 3 years ago. So we just don't see the need to do it faster. But probably just more important than the plan is the debate and discussion that is going on right now between central and local government, the infrastructure industry, and the public sector about how to do it better. So the plan has prompted a big shift in perceptions and the quality of analysis around infrastructure. And
the plan refers to the Canterbury earthquakes and how they increase the emphasis on the need for the resilience of these networks, and it talks about the need to look at the design and construction of infrastructure networks. Is that a simple, you might tap regulations around ensuring that these networks are built to a higher standard to withstand shock like earthquakes and other disasters?
Well, it's something we'll certainly be paying attention to. I mean, that's going on now with the Commission in Christchurch looking at the building standards. That's going to affect everybody in New Zealand. All the electricity companies paying attention to Orion's experience. A lot of discussion about, you know, a second international cable for the ultra-fast broadband for resilience purposes as well as competitive purposes. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much built in now.
There's been a lot of talk about the Auckland-Hamilton towering triangle. Is that, would you say, the most important part of the country to focus on, sort of transport infrastructure-wise in terms of helping the exporting sector?
It's certainly one of the most important areas right now, is that whole Auckland-Hamilton-Tauranga nexus, because actually that's where the biggest limitations are, the existing infrastructure, and certainly the roading infrastructure, but also the best use currently of the rail infrastructure. But I would also add the network around Christchurch and also the network north of Wellington. One of the challenges in the whole of the Lower North Island is to get some very positive economic growth in the private sector. And transport infrastructure is quite a limiting factor currently, which is why we're talking quite a lot about the investment in the Live Into Wellington Road of national significance, but also some of the rail investment as well.
My colleagues in Auckland were quite anxious to find out about the second harbour crossing. Is that something, you know, in terms of the vision around transport in the next 20 years, is that something that would fall under, you know, this kind of report, or is that...
Well, it will get covered more in detail in the various upcoming transport reports. But if you look at the Auckland infrastructure, there's a very significant bow wave of expenditure right now in terms of the Western Ring Route, in terms of the projects currently on State Highway 1, and also the Metro Rail projects in Auckland. That's easily the biggest layout of transport infrastructure. Now, that will get us through to around 2014-15. If you look beyond that, the next two really big projects are the Harbour Crossing and also the proposal for CBD rail link. And those proposals will get assessed over the next couple of years, including what the Harbour Crossing will look like, whether it's a tunnel or a bridge. It's quite challenging. Both of them are quite challenging, actually. The current benefit-cost ratios for both projects are well less than one. So there's a lot of work to do in terms of getting them to the point where they are ready to run, and that'll be a focus for transport planners and also for the spatial plan in Auckland over the next little while.
Given the extent of the red zone in Christchurch, presumably there'll be no infrastructure to be replaced over there quite from this, why hasn't the $5.5 billion changed? I mean, I would have thought the government's costs would have lowered if you were abandoning areas of infrastructure replacement.
Well, more correctly, the householders there are going to make a choice about whether they take the government deal or not. There could be some reduction in costs. We've taken a reasonably conservative view around the $5.5 billion on the one hand, made sure it's a relatively generous provision to cover unexpected contingencies. On the other hand, being pretty sceptical about cost reductions. So if you just take the example of infrastructure in the red zone, you've still got to dig the hole. That's the expensive, but it's just you're pulling the pipe out and you're not replacing it. So you save the cost of the pipes. And up to now, that doesn't look to be significant enough to change the provision. And also, there's still, you know, quite a bit of uncertainty about the rate and timing at which people are going to leave those areas. Plus, as we work through the orange zone, we could find significantly more or significantly less properties where you might get that kind of saving. But so, unders and overs, we'll see where it ends up.
Derail away from this issue. I mean, has there been any progress in the red zone and the orange zone classifications?
Well,
you'd
best to talk to the Minister for Earthquake Recovery on that.
On roads, the plan talks about them requiring a more sophisticated road pricing system to enable management of demand and pricing. There's also talked about specifically around issues for Auckland. Are we sort of looking at greater use of tolls or other forms of user charges to fund the current development?
Well, it talks about in the longer term, certainly not in terms of the completion of the current motorway network, which is the Western Ring Route, Waterview, as we know, which is the biggest remaining part of that, which we should hear more about in the next few days. That one is committed to out of the National Land Transport Fund. But when you get to talking about another harbour crossing, where you're talking somewhere between high threes and $5 billion on its own, then you'll start to talk once again about the cost of doing that and who's going to pay what share. And it'll be a combination, I imagine, with a project of that size of ratepayers and road users. We're a long way from discussing the funding of that, but to me that will be the catalyst for that discussion to appear again over the next couple of years as people think about how they might pay for that. But the other part of it is that once the existing network is complete, then obviously there's limited opportunities to add to that given the very built-up nature of the Auckland Isthmus. But again, we think that's probably those sort of questions being talked about in terms of getting on towards 10 years out, not 2 years out.
You talked about cost-benefit analysis for the harbour crossings before, but I mean, with the broadband, there wasn't really any cost-benefit analysis done. When do you decide whether to do that and act on it and when not to?
Well, in the case of the transport projects, you have a very large number and a very large range of projects in the transport sector that people want you to invest in. So one of the comparative means by which you assess those is those benefit cost analyses and basically putting the same ruler across everything. That helps prioritise projects, and then you have the strategic element to that as well. The broadband project is a single large project, which is a strategic investment the government has made the call to make. Has a number of supporting analyses done, both domestically, we started out with the New Zealand Institute, but also internationally, which indicate the range of benefits in terms of additions to GDP growth from these sorts of projects and from increased availability of high-speed broadband. And the final and most difficult part of the broadband exercise is actually estimating and providing the actual estimate of benefits given how quickly that sector is moving. So there are a range of studies internationally, but getting down to an exact BC analysis, you have to make some very big assumptions up front about usage and about timing. Which on balance we thought were in reality very, very subjective anyway, so we relied on the international assessments.
So in terms of those roading projects, are you going to wait until you get a cost-benefit ratio of one or above before you go ahead with them? Or?
In most cases you have that, and certainly in the strategic sense all the roads of national significance meet that criteria. But again, you have a strategic element to those as well, and probably the best example of that is Transmission Gully, because it's often talked about as having a reasonably low benefit-cost analysis, and that's true. The topography makes it so. If you really wanted a good BC in the case of Transmission Gully, you'd build Wellington somewhere else. Unfortunately, we haven't, so we are a little bit stuck with the geography that we're dealing with.
Okay.
Sorry, Mr. Small.
There you go.
No, I just saw the headline.
Yeah. I'll certainly spice up the press conference. Okay. Well, I'm here to tell you Wellington's staying where it is and also to move on to Pike River.